Mr. Weldy.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ronald E. Weldy on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Harney et al., and the four proposed classes. It is the contention of the employees in this matter that employer has violated Indiana's wage and hour laws, specifically the Indiana Wage Payment Statute and Indiana Wage Claim Statute, with regard to, first off, the manner in which the monthly and quarterly bonuses were paid throughout the employees in question's tenure with the company, and secondly, with regard to the forfeiture of said bonuses upon the separation of employment, and that's where you involve not only the wage payment statute, but Indiana's wage claim statute as well. And that's the reason why we have four classes here, because we have people receiving monthly bonuses that make up one class during their tenure. We have people receiving quarterly bonuses that make up another class. We have people who voluntarily quit or resign that make up the quit class and have their bonuses forfeited. And then we have people who, in the termination class, who are terminated and their claims will fall under Indiana's wage claim statute. Respectfully, it's a position of appellants that this court should certify three different questions to the Indiana Supreme Court. And the reason why is because, quite frankly, this case is addressing several issues that are on the forefront, right on the cutting edge of developing Indiana's wage and hour statutes and, you know, understanding how those apply to the different pay practices that Indiana employers have. The first question is whether the bonuses earned by the employees constitute a wage, and that is really the pivotal question in this case. And quite frankly, other than the Indiana Court of Appeals in the Swift versus Speedway Super America case, no other court at the Court of Appeals level, or more specifically the Indiana Supreme Court, has had an opportunity to look at a bonus of this nature to determine whether or not it's a wage or not.
Well, but in the Swift case, they looked at bonuses like this, and they said they weren't the subject of the wage payment statute. So that case isn't – I mean, that case certainly doesn't help you.
Actually, Your Honor, you're incorrect in that point. In the Swift case, which actually had the identical counsel involved, the Indiana Court of Appeals held that the it was a 2004 store manager's bonus was, in fact, a wage. They held that it was deferred compensation that could be forfeited.
But it wasn't the subject of the wage payment statute.
No, Your Honor, because Ms. Swift had been terminated, it was underneath the wage claim statute. But the definition of wages is identical between the wage claim statute and the wage payment statute. In actuality, the only definition put forth in the statute is actually located in Indiana's wage claim statutes, and by case law, both at the Indiana Court of Appeals level and at the Indiana Supreme Court level, in wage payment statutes, the Indiana appellate courts have repeatedly looked to that definition set forth in the wage claim statute to have the same definition. So the fact that the Swift Court found the store manager 2004 program store manager bonus to be a wage under the Indiana's wage claim statute is equally applicable to all of these different bonuses pursuant to Indiana's wage payment statute.
Well, is it your position that these bonuses, which are calculated based on a variety of factors and comparisons, readily can it be determined within a 10-day period?
Your Honor, first off, I would note that that's not a determinative factor as to whether or not something is a wage or not, quite frankly.
But the bottom line is there's not evidence in this record that you can calculate these bonuses in less than 10 days, right?
There's no evidence presented by employer that it can't be done, and there's no evidence by the employer that it can be done. The only thing we have is one sentence in an affidavit that says it can't be done with absolutely no explanation why.
Well, isn't it hard to determine what profits were or what the, you know, store's quarterly earnings are within a 10-day period? You're saying that?
Not to my understanding, Your Honor. The different employees I work with, which I work with numerous different companies, you know, these large corporations that we have these days are dealing with computerized accounting and everything, you know, all the different sales go right into the computer and it goes right into a certain category, and they, you know, they pretty much know instantaneously what you know, what a store is doing at any point in time simply by querying the server for that particular store, and they could say, well, we've sold so many cartons of cigarettes, and we, you know, I mean, Your Honor, I'm presupposing all this stuff. This is my basic experience. The fact of the matter is the record is devoid of any information to conclude either way, and that's our point. You cannot simply make a conclusory statement in an affidavit that it is impossible to determine this bonus within a 10-day period and expect that to be expect that to be factual and upheld by any court. I mean, I have no way of challenging that conclusory statement without them actually giving us some explanation as to why it can't be done. And quite frankly, given computerized accounting that we have these days, it doesn't make any sense to me. And that is the point. The second question that we would ask be certified to the Indiana Supreme Court has to do with whether or not the retention provision that is an aspect of each of these different bonus programs.
Let me just go back to the prior just to make sure in terms of these various factors within the 10-day period. For example, these store managers, theirs is based on monthly performance objectives, and those include the monthly sales margins compared to the same month in the previous year, as well as an evaluation of store losses, safety, overtime hours, and quality assurance score. So all those things go into the formula.
Correct. And actually, Your Honor, it's not a formula. If you look on page 22 of the short appendix, that sets forth...
Or objectives, I guess.
Right. And actually, I used the word criteria in my brief, and as I was preparing for oral argument, it dawned on me that probably the better word would be component, because out of the 11, or I guess there's 12 in 2005, when we're talking about the store manager bonus, you can actually obtain different bonuses. I mean, it says that the light product break even, and I'm looking at the 2005 bonus store manager bonus program, makes up 30% of your bonus. So if you meet the goal there, you get 30% of what you can possibly earn for that month. If you don't, then that 30% is gone. But it doesn't mean that you don't get the rest of the components that you met. These are actually all separate elements that are done at one time and put into one bonus check. But the reality is that they can all be separately earned. So, you know, to the extent that if at any point in time this court were to conclude, well, you know, this component looks like it's based upon profitability or something like that, well, great. Say that's not a wage. But the components that are not based upon profitability, that are based upon purely the performance of the employees, those components have to be a wage. And so, in essence, this can be broken up. And very simply, we can go back and look, okay, this manager earned a $1,000 bonus. How is that? What different components did the manager earn in order to make up that $1,000, and then break out which ones are wages and which ones may not be wages, even though we don't concede that any of these different components don't make up a wage, to be quite honest. Your Honor, as I was saying, the second question to be certified to the Indiana Supreme Court, in our opinion, has to do with the retention provision that is in each of the different bonus programs that we're talking about here. And specifically, what I'm talking about is the fact that the monthly or the quarterly bonuses in question are earned, and it says it in the bonus program, it uses the word earned, during a particular month or a particular quarter, and then they supposedly don't earn it again unless the employee is there on the last day of the second month ending the month or the quarter in question, and then it doesn't get paid out until the second pay date after that day in question. And an issue that's never been presented to any Indiana court except for the Swift Court, which ignored the issue, is whether or not that type of retention provision violates Indiana's 10-day rule, which the Indiana Supreme Court articulated on April 27th of 2007 in the Naugle versus Beech Grove City Schools case. Now, given that we literally are coming up on the one-year anniversary of the Naugle versus Beech Grove City Schools case, it makes absolute sense that, you know, the Indiana Supreme Court, let alone the Indiana Court of Appeals, has not had an opportunity to look at this type of issue before. And as such, given that, you know, this retention element is dispositive, that if this court were to find these bonuses to be wages, whether or not the bonuses were paid late with regard to both the monthly and the quarterly class, this is an extremely important issue, and one literally of a first impression to be decided by a court, and that's why it should be certified to the Indiana Supreme Court. Finally, the third question that we feel should be certified is the question of whether or not these bonus wages constitute present or deferred compensation. Now, the first time that any court brought up the notion that there was present and deferred compensation was in the Williams versus Riverside Community Correction case back in 2006. And, Your Honor, I should note that each of the cases I've cited so far, I was actually plaintiff's counsel on all these cases before either the Indiana Court of Appeals or the Indiana Supreme Court. And in the Williams case, the Court of Appeals decided to break up compensation in what is present compensation, which includes things like the wages that one earns by their work, commissions, even though no court has said that yet, it kind of makes sense. You sell something, it's based upon performance. And in our opinion, it's any performance-based bonuses, that those should all be present compensation. Deferred compensation, which the Swift versus Speedway Super America Court of Appeals case said that the store manager bonus case falls underneath, in our opinion, is wages that one earns by their tenure with the employer. Meaning you don't have to perform a certain way. You simply work for our company for a particular period of time, and by your tenure with the company, we're going to give you a certain amount of sick wages. We're going to give you a certain amount of vacation wages. You're going to be eligible for a 401k. You're going to have other retirement compensation. Those types of benefits that one simply gets because you are working for that company. In our mind, that is what deferred compensation is. However, at this point, we've only got the Williams case. We have the Indiana Court of Appeals decision in the Swift case discussing what wages are and are not deferred compensation, and no case law whatsoever from the Indiana Supreme Court on this issue. And it is a pivotal issue because, once again, if this court were to find these bonuses to be wages, then the ability to forfeit these wages has to be contractual. And admittedly, it's indisputed that there is no contract in this case stating that the bonuses are forfeited upon a separation, either voluntary or involuntary separation. So all three of these questions are literally on the cutting edge of Indiana wage and hour law, and for that reason, they have not been addressed by the Indiana Supreme Court. And in order for this case to proceed, we feel that the Indiana Supreme Court should weigh in on these extremely important issues.
On any of these questions, Mr. Weldy, do you feel that High House is at all instructive?
Your Honor, I mean, High House, you're dealing with a doctor with a base salary of $250,000.
Well, what's the difference between that and somebody who makes $25,000?
Well, Your Honor, in the St. Vincent versus Steele case, another case involving a highly paid doctor, Justice Boehm wrote a concurring opinion. And in that concurring opinion, he said that there was a difference. He believes that Indiana's wage and hour statutes, and specifically that case dealt with the wage payment statute, but also touched upon Indiana's wage claim statute. He believed that the focus of those two statutes should be on the majority of Indian employees out there who live week to week, because those are the people who are, you know, need their wages in order to pay their current bills and do not have the means to go out and protect themselves, and questioned whether a doctor like Dr. Steele in that case should actually be protected by Indiana's wage payment statute. And quite frankly, Your Honor, with regard to all the bonus cases that really have went up to the Indiana Court of Appeals or the Indiana Supreme Court, with the exception of Swift, we are looking at cases involving high-priced executives or doctors. We're dealing with presidents. We're dealing with plant managers. In my mind, we're talking about blue-collar bonuses here. These are the
I appreciate that, but those are policy arguments. Is the Indiana legislature given any indication in either its legislative history or anything else?
No, you cannot find legislative history. You can't, unfortunately. And the wage payment statute was actually just amended effective July 1st of 2007. at the same time that the Indiana Supreme Court was looking at the 10-day rule, the legislator went ahead and changed it from 10 days to 10 business days, even though the Supreme Court, on the very same day that Governor Daniels signed that law into effect, went ahead and ruled that it was 10 business days. So, unfortunately, there is no legislative history. I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weldon. Mr. Groves?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is William Groth, and I'm representing Speedway Super America. Speedway Super America operates approximately 1,650 convenience stores and gasoline stations in a 9-state area in the Midwest, including the state of Indiana, the state of Ohio, and I believe the state of Illinois as well. The district court in this case applied settled Indiana case law in determining that Speedway's bonuses are not a wage for purposes of either the Indiana wage payment or the Indiana wage claim statutes because those bonuses are not compensation for time worked and because they are bonuses paid for the attainment of financial targets and the achievement of individual personal objectives within a particular Speedway store. Judge McKinney, in granting summary judgment to Speedway, relied on two Indiana Supreme Court decisions, the High House decision, as well as the more recent Naugle decision, in arriving at that conclusion. And although I would acknowledge that the employee's efforts may in some immeasurable way contribute to the amount of those bonuses, they are largely dictated by factors beyond the employee's ability to control, and therefore, under well-established Indiana case law, those bonuses are not a wage and therefore are not subject to either the penalty provisions or the payment provisions of the Indiana wage statutes. In fact, the most recent Indiana Court of Appeals decision interpreting those statutes, a case called Kopka-Pincus, which we cite in our brief, held that the amount of time or the employee's effort in calculating those bonuses must be the sole factor in order for those bonuses to be a wage subject to the wage payment and wage claim statutes. And in addition, a secondary factor, I don't think it's a primary factor, but a secondary factor is that given the large number of stores that Speedway has and Speedway operates and the rather complicated formula that it uses in calculating these bonuses, the bonuses simply can't be calculated within 10 days after the month in which they are accrued. There was evidence or is evidence in the record in the form of an affidavit from Speedway's manager of benefits and compensation to that effect that was not challenged by the appellant in the court below, and it stands uncontradicted. And it doesn't state just an opinion. It states a fact that these bonuses cannot be calculated within 10 days. And so, in short, since the calculation and amount of these bonuses are dependent on factors other than the employee's efforts, to use Justice Bohm's words in High House, they are not wages under either the High House or Naugle decisions and not subject to the wage payment statutes. And I would also add that the employees in this case are not contending that we didn't follow our published policies. They acknowledge that we did. What they are apparently arguing is that those published policies somehow on their face violate the wage payment statutes because of the retention or the continuation of employment factor. But they have no case law to support that, and we believe that there's a clear path to the result reached by Judge McKinney and the court below to arrive at that decision. And that clear path is charted by the Supreme Court's decisions in High House and Naugle. Now, even if these bonuses were considered a wage for purposes of the sake of argument, they are at most a form of deferred compensation. And deferred compensation is, again, under settled Indiana case law, subject to forfeiture upon an employee's failure to comply with a published condition for the payment of that deferred compensation. One of those factors can be the mere passage of time and continued employment. As the Indiana Court of Appeals said in a case called Mitchell versus Universal Solutions, which is cited in our brief, if an employee has a right to earn deferred compensation under a published policy, the employer has the right to take away that deferred compensation, and I quote, under any circumstances clearly elucidated in the published policy, end of quote. The circumstance that's clearly elucidated in Speedway's policy is that the manager must be in the payroll, actively employed, at the end of the second month, following the month in which the bonus is accrued. Accordingly, the 10-day for payment rule of the wage payment statute isn't triggered with respect to deferred compensation until the employee's entitlement to that deferred compensation vests indefeasibly under the employer's policy. And here that date is the last day of the second month. The Indiana Court of Appeals, in another case called Williams versus Riverside Community Corrections Corporation, as well as in the Swift case, which involves the same parties, and by the way, Judge Williams, I think you're aware of this, but the Supreme Court had an opportunity to review the Swift case, but declined, and that declination was unanimous. But in Williams, as well in Swift, the Court of Appeals observed that deferred compensation can come in many forms, as it is often structured to meet the particular needs of a given employer. And if the employee fails to fulfill the published conditions precedent to the payment of that deferred compensation, it is subject to forfeiture. A good example is vacation pay, which it accrues over time, and you would otherwise earn it, but it can be forfeited by the terms of a published policy. For example, sometimes the published policy says the employee must be employed on his or her anniversary date of employment. Or it might say that the employee has to give a specified notice of intent to quit in order to receive that accrued vacation pay. Or it might say that the employee cannot be terminated for cause and still receive accrued vacation pay. So the point is that deferred compensation is, in fact, subject to forfeiture by virtue of the explicit provisions of the employer's policy. And here we have explicit provisions that Speedway indisputably complied with, and therefore, even if these bonuses were wages, and we don't agree that they were, but even if they were, they were afforded a form of deferred compensation, and the accrual date, or I'm sorry, the vested date, the indefeasible vesting date was the last day of the second month following the month in which these bonuses were accrued. Now, I'll just say a quick word about the policy, Speedway's policy underlying this continued employment requirement. I think it's pretty obvious, as Judge McKinney indicated, it's designed to give employees an incentive to stay and to so that Speedway doesn't have to hire a number of new managers because of high turnover and train those managers. It wants to protect its investment in these managers, and therefore it's given them an incentive to continue to work. Now, with respect to the argument that any of these issues should be certified to the Indiana Supreme Court, we don't think that's the least bit necessary. The Supreme Court, as esteemed opposing counsel has indicated, has visited this issue of what constitutes, when a bonus constitutes a wage, at least twice over the last several years in the High House and Noggle cases. It's had numerous opportunities to review other cases on petitions to transfer, including in the Williams case, including the Swift case, and there are one or two others involving these or similar issues. And in every instance, the Supreme Court has unanimously declined to accept the offer or the petition to transfer, and thereby declined an opportunity to further elucidate the law in this area. I believe, as a labor and employment lawyer, that the law is extremely well settled in this case, and that it would serve no useful purpose for this court to certify any issue to the Indiana Supreme Court. Unless the court has any questions, I will defer the remainder of my time. I'll yield it.
Thank you, Mr. Groth. Mr. Weldon.
Your Honor, with regard to the retention element, the one aspect that we have here that, quite frankly, you can't point to an example of it applying in any case that's ever dealt with this issue is we have a situation where, and I'll use the example of vacation time. If an employer says, hey, you have to work for us for a year before you're allowed to get vacation time, after that year's over, then they're allowed to take the vacation time. To put it in the context of this case, that would be like an employer saying, you have to work for us for a year, and then you wait 6 months thereafter, and then you're allowed to take the vacation time. Okay? You're looking beyond the period of time set up by the employer when the wage is going to be calculated, which time you've earned the wage. And then you're saying, and we're going to condition it even beyond that. And you don't see that in any other context. I've never come across that. I know that the vacation claims cases out there are the ones that deal with it the most readily, but you've never seen a vacation case like that where they say, you got a year to do it, but then you can't take it for another 6 months.
Is it, other than saying you got to work 18 months for the vacation rather than a year, isn't that the effect of it?
Your Honor, no, because in essence, it ignores the 10-day rule. I mean, the 10-day rule says you earn wages and you have to get paid for them within 10 business days. And, you know, once again, we're back to the question of deferred versus present compensation.
If it had been phrased differently in the initial employment thing, it says you earn after 18 months you can take it, then it would have been okay, you're saying?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, we do have recently in September 5th of 2007, the Real versus Clarion Health Partners case that says that an employment policy cannot contradict Indiana law. And so, in essence, what I'm saying is the published policies as written contradict Indiana law, and that's why we have to defer to Indiana law. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks, Swelly. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And